The fact that we are being delayed by action because we're so focused on this thing, the Green New Deal, that doesn't have anything to do with climate change, pisses me off. It really does. Because I want to fight for a cleaner future so that when I have kids someday, and that when I leave, when we leave this planet to a new generation of people, that they have a planet that is inhabitable, that is prosperous. The Green New Deal does not do that, and most Americans know that.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. Today's production quality might be a little bit different because I'm doing this one on the road while visiting my boyfriend's family out in Michigan, but I've got a great guest to bring to you today, Benji Backer, the president and founder of the American Conservation Coalition. Benji, thanks for coming on the show.
It is great, great, great to be here, and glad you're in the Midwest.
Yeah, I'm from New England, so it's very different. I was driving around, and I was like, is this Nebraska? Is this cornfields? And then all of a sudden, you're in Grand Rapids, and it's a city.
Well, there's a very clear hierarchy of Midwestern states, and thankfully for you, Michigan is in the top half.
Okay. Some people will have opinions on that, for
sure. Yeah, I'm sure they will. For the record, it's Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, and then...
Everyone hates Ohio, apparently.
I don't want to offend everyone else.
But anyway, obviously, for the folks that don't know, ACC is a right-of-center environmentalist and conservation organization advocating for pro-environment policies and politics from a conservative or Republican perspective. Can you just start? Because I think, unfortunately, this gets muddled a lot. When we talk about climate change, when you guys talk about climate change, what are you talking about exactly?
So with climate change specifically, we feel not only that conservatives need to raise their voice because of the political need, which is pretty obvious when you look at young people and their voting records, when you look at what young people prioritize, climate change is number one. But if you care about the environment, you also need to care about climate change, because the reality is what we've been told about it being a doomsday, doom and gloom scenario isn't true. But what is true is that the climate is changing, that humans have an impact on it, and even a small impact on our temperature, a small impact in terms of glaciers melting or hurricanes or hot temperatures, that still makes a huge difference. And we feel like as a conservative movement, we should not only raise our voice to the table, but propose our own solutions that solve climate change in an economically sound way, which we know we can do.
So if on one hand we have kind of the left-wing narrative that everything will fall apart in 9 years, the sun will explode, obviously I'm being facetious, right? But you go back and read Al Gore's documentary, or watch it rather, the predictions did not come true, many of them. But so there is that approach. But then on the other hand, I guess, you have boomer conservatives who say climate change is a Chinese hoax. Where do you land on that spectrum and why?
So the alarmism, the denialism that has basically created what is seen as the political polar extremes on this issue have both got it completely wrong. They both have it completely wrong because it's not what the science says. And as a person that cares about the future, I want to look at the science, right? The science itself says that we do have an impact on temperature, that temperatures are increasing faster than they should because of carbon emissions in the atmosphere. That means that that's going to create some small changes that have big impacts. A 1 degree difference on an extremely hot day could be the difference between a glacier melting and not melting during that course of the day. You know, those small changes, and that's of course a microscopic view of it, but those changes have a huge impact on society. We know that the economic, national security and environmental impacts of climate change could be very severe if we don't do something about it. But we also know that we can solve it in a way that is locally sourced, is really focused on market reforms instead of the government, is focused on innovation instead of regulation. We can solve it in a way that is very, very good for all Americans and also the entire globe. But the reality is climate change is a global problem because we all emit carbon individually and we all emit carbon across the world. There are some countries that are increasing their emissions while America is decreasing ours. And so we have to be realistic about, if we're going to pass a policy, does it make a difference globally, or does it just make a difference here in the United States? Because if it doesn't make a difference globally, there's no point.
Well, I was actually going to ask you about that later on, but I might as well just do it now. Yeah. What you just described about climate change is definitely where I land on the issue from the reading and the research I've done about it. Is obviously it's a real problem, but it's not as doomsday as some people would have you believe. But there is some question about, and maybe this is me just being a tad nihilistic, what can we even do about it? Because were the U.S. to cease all carbon emissions tomorrow, right, but you still had India and China pumping out massive amounts of CO2, and China particularly doesn't seem at all interested in stopping. I mean, to some extent, is this a train that we can't really get off of?
Well, I would argue that it's a train that we have to get off of, and that there is a way to get off of it. But it's not in the way that the left has been talking about this. The reality is the left has had an opportunity to fight climate change for decades, and they've had positions where they've had complete power in the United States, in the Senate, the House, and the president, and they pretty much have that now, and they still aren't able to move forward on it. That makes people like you and a lot of other people feel very skeptical that, okay, well, if that hasn't worked, and obviously those policies are bad, but if that hasn't worked, and you know the United States hasn't been able to pass any policies, and globally emissions are increasing because of China and India, then what is the point? The point, I think, that a lot of people are missing is that the biggest economic opportunity over the next few decades will be who is winning the race for a sustainable future technologically. Who is creating those solar panels? Who is creating the wind turbines? Who's creating the electric cars? That's going to be the biggest economic opportunity for whoever capitalizes on it. The reason why the United States should take a leadership role is not only because we can set an example on an issue that we should be setting an example on, but there's also an immense economic incentive. And right now, China, even though they're increasing their emissions, is killing us at the race for a sustainable future from a manufacturing and production standpoint. They are creating the solar panels. They are mining for those materials. They are the ones creating and financing nuclear energy projects. So that's a big problem. And then on top of that, we do have time to solve this issue. The train is not too far away from the station. We can catch up and get back on it. We have time to fight climate change. The goal would be getting carbon neutral by 2050, which is a very, you know, wonky thing. But there is a path to getting there. And that's what the science says. And so if we can get there, we absolutely should fight towards that.
So let's talk about how, and specifically on the policy and economic front, because one thing I really dislike is that people on the left, the activist left, will say, the science says climate change is happening. True. And then they'll say, so therefore we need the Green New Deal. And that's mm-hmm. the science. But there's a big difference between the problem and then what necessarily the solution is. So maybe let's do this in two parts. But just to start, the idea that we need a massive expansion of government control of the economy with, you know, a civilian climate corps funded by the government and the government regulating all fossil fuels out of existence and spending $32 trillion on everything from free healthcare to community college to daycare to all the other things that are in the Green New Deal, right? That approach, why is that not something people should go along with?
Well, to answer the first thing that you were saying, I mean, the all or nothing approach to fighting climate change is absolutely absurd. That's like saying, you know, I've got a problem with my roommate. He's being really annoying, so I'm just gonna murder him. You know, that's like you're like going from like this thing that you is a problem to like the most drastic possible thing that you don't need to do, and is absolutely absurd, and probably actually just ends up hurting you more than anything else. That's what the Green New Deal is. It's not necessary, and it does hurt us more than it needs to, because it's not about the environment. It's not about protecting the environment. The Green New Deal is about overhauling the economy. And AOC's chief of staff said that. He said that. It's not even a secret. So if you care about climate change like I do, I'm an avid hiker, an avid skier. I love the outdoors. And the moment I get out of politics, I will be spending every moment I can in the outdoors. As someone who passionately cares about the outdoors, the fact that we are being delayed by action because we're so focused on this thing, the Green New Deal, that doesn't have anything to do with climate change, pisses me off. It really does. Because I want to fight for a cleaner future so that when I have kids someday, and that when I leave, you know, when we leave this planet to a new generation of people, that they have a planet that is inhabitable, that is prosperous. The Green New Deal does not do that, and most Americans know that. And so when that's the only alternative, there's two potential outcomes. One, we don't take action on climate change at all because we're bickering about this all or nothing solution that really doesn't actually protect the environment. Or we get the Green New Deal, and then that's terrible too. So that's where conservatives, or honestly just fair-minded people in the center or center right, even the center left, need to stand up and say, look, I understand this is an issue. The Green New Deal is not the answer. So here's what we want to see in the future. And the reality is, you know, we could talk for hours about what those solutions look like. Just like any issue, it's way more complicated than saying, oh, we just need this one policy. It's not that simple. There are so many different things that need to happen for us to reverse the trend of climate change and to grow our economy at the same time. That makes it a little bit more complicated and confusing. I can't come up here on this podcast and say, ban fossil fuels and pass a Green New Deal. It's not that simple. So it does, you start to lose people because it's too complicated, but we have to have that nuance in this conversation.
Yeah, I do. A couple of things there. One is you talked about leaving it to the next generation. I almost view climate change how I view the national debt, right? It's pretty, in my view, immoral and disgraceful that we're just running up a huge credit card tab for the next people down the line to pay for. Well, basically, pollution is a form of intergenerational robbery, right? You're taking something today and imposing the cost on someone else down the line without their consent. So that's why I do want to do something about it. But I will say, I sometimes think that both on the left and the right, the climate change conversation, it is so complicated, right? So is every policy issue. But then sometimes it just seems like people only offer hand-wavy solutions, right? Like, well, we need to solve the problem through innovation and public-private partnerships. But it's like, well, what are the specifics that we can do? So can we talk about some of those? I mean, what's your position on a carbon tax?
Yeah, so really good question, and I'll answer both of those. The carbon tax, just to start out, if you look at a white paper and you read the policy and you're a market-minded person, you would say, you know, I could potentially get behind this, but in practice, it doesn't work so well, and there's a few reasons why. The first is because it puts a price on carbon, which means that A, companies that can afford that price are going to be able to pay for it. And then the smaller companies get put out of business, which is why you see the big companies being for it in the United States, the big oil companies being for it. And on top of that, you pass along those costs to consumers. When you raise a price on carbon, which I do think that there is a cost to carbon, right? Like there's a cost to my life and your life because of pollution. But when you raise the cost of producing energy for people, it increases their own bills and it decreases the depth of their pocketbooks, which is something that most people can't afford in this country, especially those living paycheck to paycheck. So in practice, it's really difficult to rectify that. And on top, it's not a global solution. You're just exporting your energy development to other countries, or you're charging your own country more for that energy production. It's one or the other. Unless there was a global price on carbon, you wouldn't be able to do that. And obviously that's not going to happen. So that's why I'm skeptical of it. Now, we as an organization have not taken a stance on it from like a, oh, we are so against this or oh, we are for this. But we also have a very diverse team that has different opinions on the topic. And I think that that also shows what the last problem that the carbon price has, which is that politically it's very unfeasible right now. You have people even on our own team who love it and people who are on our own team hate it and people who don't, who are kind of in the middle on it. And in this country, you have the far left that says no policy is good enough unless it's a Green New Deal. And then you have the center left, which thinks the carbon tax doesn't go far enough either. Then you have kind of the center right who loves a carbon tax, which is a very small group of people. And then you have the more conservative base, either they deny climate change or they believe that it's a thing but don't want this policy. And so it's a very difficult policy to pass. And the reason why I am so skeptical of it as a person is because it is kind of a one-size-fits-all thing. We're talking about carbon tax or bust a lot of the times when we're talking about the carbon tax. And the reality is, just as we've been talking about, this issue is way more complicated than a carbon tax.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings on it. I definitely was at one point pretty strongly in favor of it because the theory of it, right, from an economics point of view, right, is very strong.
Very strong.
The idea of internalizing the externality, right? But it assumes economic models, and I'm sure you know this, but for listeners' sake, assume a few things that are actually pretty unrealistic, one of which is perfect information. So the idea of behind a carbon tax is that there's extra costs by emitting carbon, and that if you added a tax for the value of those costs, well, then people would only emit the right amount of carbon. But that assumes the government knows what those costs are, but they're actually extremely hard to quantify. So that's not something I think bureaucrats huddled in DC would really be able to do with any sort of accuracy. And then there's the international problem. It's like, if we pass a carbon tax, wouldn't that just result in more emissions in countries with actually lower environmental standards? So I think it's a complicated one.
It's very complicated.
But we don't want to just, at least I hate when I'm, and I do find myself in this sometimes, just being the no guy saying that won't work, that won't work, that won't work. So what are the tangible things, just to maybe focus on a couple, because I'm sure that you could write books about this, that conservatives who do care about climate change could and can support in terms of that policy steps to directly address it that are in line with, you know, right of center beliefs?
Yeah. So first of all, the most powerful solution to climate change is the marketplace. You have so much power with your dollar to change the way companies are acting. And no one knows that. I mean, we are feeding into climate change by not using our dollars to buy sustainable products and not to buy products that are made in the United States instead of made in China. Like, there are so many things you can do as an individual that's not even at the policy level that I think people lose sight of. And we have so much more power than we think. So that's the first thing. In terms of actual policy, there are a few areas where I feel like we can make some really big strides that conservatives can get behind. The first is nuclear energy. Nuclear energy is the most efficient and the cleanest source of energy on this earth. And it also is the safest. The problem that it has is that it's been so overregulated by the government when the other energy sources, including oil, gas, wind, solar, coal, they've all been subsidized. Clean energy or not, they've been subsidized. Nuclear has literally had the opposite. It's been overregulated and it has created that price disparity where people are like, yeah, I like nuclear, but it's just too expensive. So there's two ways to do that, to fix that problem. The first is to roll back unnecessary regulation. Of course, if there is a regulation that, you know, keeps people from radioactive waste being in their water, that's probably pretty important. But there are a lot of really unimportant regulations that have held it back just because of the stigma and the stereotype. The second thing is pouring some money into investing in next generation nuclear. And I'm not just talking about government money. You're seeing billionaires and investors put it into private sector companies as well. There is an opportunity to create nuclear that is small scale, but small scale in terms of its size, like it's not a huge power plant, but it has a huge impact. Nuclear is really important because it has the power to power every single community in this country, whereas wind and solar are intermittent. They're smaller scale sources. They're still great, but they're smaller scale. So nuclear is first. The second thing that I think is really important is figuring out how to capture carbon. Carbon is a pollutant in our atmosphere that we are emitting because of driving and energy production and that sort of thing. Obviously, we should be shifting to lower energy substitutes as much as possible. But until we can get to a point where that's completely feasible, which could be a while, we need to figure out how to lower those carbon emissions. The best way to do that is to plant trees, to restore wetlands, to create more habitat in natural areas, to look at technology that can capture carbon in the air and put it underground where it once came from. Those are really simple, easy ways that can support local communities, and it also doesn't have a huge negative environmental impact or economic impact, and it has a huge environmental impact. So those are a couple of key areas. On top of that, I could write an entire book. So you're right. I'm not going to more, but those are some easy things that I think we can do in the short term. Of course, there are long-term solutions as well.
Well, and you did mention renewables briefly there, but I want to get your overall sense on them because I have mixed feelings about renewables. Obviously, there's nothing wrong with the idea of renewables or solar panels or any of it, right? Especially when it develops in the market on its own. But it's been so heavily subsidized and so kind of consumed by like government regulation and subsidy and crony capitalism. And then you have things like Solyndra that go bust at the taxpayer's expense. And it seems to me like it's become very swampy because of how involved government is with it. And I'm not so optimistic about the prospects of renewable energy just getting us all out of this, putting nuclear in a different category, which I think is great. But how do you view the state of play with renewables and how big a piece of them are they to the answer to the problem?
Yeah, it's a really, really good question as well. And I think it's a question that a lot of conservatives and libertarians and non-climate hawks are wondering, right? Like, how feasible is this whole renewable thing? I think what's important to remember about the subsidy conversation is that for better or for worse, and for me, I think it is oftentimes for worse, the oil and gas sector has been subsidized far more than these renewables have been. And a lot of times getting an energy source off the ground takes that investment, unfortunately, because just like a business, you have to start somewhere. So there are realities behind it that I think people need to remember. And that's not to say that we should totally ignore some of the unnecessary subsidies that are going to wind and solar. There definitely are a lot out there. But today, the cost of wind and solar is significantly plummeting on its own because of technological improvement now that it's kind of at the market, which is especially why there shouldn't need to be any like crazy subsidies. But they also are having an opportunity to power communities in a way that I don't think people had expected. Wind is the number two energy source in Texas. Solar is taking over in Arizona and in Republican states, wind and solar, conservative states where a lot of times people are skeptical of these things, they are in the top two or three energy sources for that state. So there definitely is a lot of opportunity, but the real challenge and the question at this point is when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining, can we use excess energy from when the wind was blowing and the sun was shining in a storage facility? And right now we can't store energy from these sources hardly at all. And so if you can only get power when the wind is blowing and the sun is shining, then there isn't a lot of efficacy to that in the broader public. It can be great throughout the day, but then when the wind stops blowing, you have to get the energy from somewhere else. So we have to be realistic about that. And I think conservatives and libertarians need to be more open to the fact that wind and solar can be very economical, but people on the left need to realize that it's not an energy source that you're going to be able to rely on at this point to turn on your lights and turn on your stoves and turn on your TVs 24 hours a day.
Well, that's one of the things that I found maddening is not the left and Democrats are very pro-renewables, and that's fine. But right. A lot of these same people are anti-nuclear. Right. So you would have people, I don't know what was in the Green New Deal specifically, but a lot of these progressive politicians, they are claiming that we need to stop all carbon emissions and we need massive renewable subsidies, but also, ban nuclear energy because it sounds scary. And the government shouldn't let them do that. How do you explain that kind of total mismatch between their arguments?
Well, the reality is there's no way to fight climate change without nuclear energy. So people who are pro-climate and advocate for everything that's quote-unquote clean without nuclear, it doesn't matter because you would never be able to reduce emissions at the scale that you need to. I don't quite understand the reasoning behind so many climate advocates being anti-nuclear. I think one of the reasons is that these activists oftentimes live off of a fear-based mentality, and the fear is what drives change for them. And being fearful of the potential downsides of nuclear, which used to be real and are not today, is an easy out for them. And they also have a lot of money being poured into them by certain industries in certain parts of the country, where it's just a lot easier to say you're pro solar and wind only. But the reality is there's no science that says we can get to a carbon-free or low carbon future without nuclear energy.
So let's talk about the politics of all of this a little bit, because I do think that's one of the interesting generational divides within the GOP. This is just my outsider's view of somebody who I'm not a registered Republican, though I'm closely involved in right of center politics. I see a next generation of elected Republicans, whether it's people like Nancy Mace or Peter Meyer or other freshmen in the House and young, even people like Matt Gaetz, whatever you think of him on other things, acknowledges climate change and talks about it. You have these younger Republicans, and then young Republican voters by polls and everything are very concerned about this. Yet then the older kind of members of Congress, many of them don't care so much or think it's a hoax. And a lot of the boomer voters, not to generalize them all, but a lot of them have kind of more outdated positions on it. Do you see everything moving in a different direction and a positive direction from your view? And do you also see that in the same way?
Absolutely. The more that the older generation passes the torch on to us, Gen Z, millennial, I don't even know what the next generation is called, but you know, the younger generation, the under 40 crowd, the more we're going to see climate action from the right of center space. I do not think that climate change can be reversed in this country, let alone the globe, without conservative leadership. And I think conservatives can actually be the party or of the movement. And libertarians can be the party and the movement. We can all kind of, the right of center space can be the movement that fought climate change head on, because the generation is shifting from this kind of climate denial and climate skepticism to climate acceptance and climate reality, right? It's like realistic solutions, realistic activism, common sense proposals that have a lasting impact. That's going to be the movement that we lead as conservatives and as libertarians and as market-minded people. I do see that changing. And you mentioned some really great people who have been carrying that torch forward, despite maybe the stereotype that conservatives don't care about climate change. You do have Peter Meyer and Nancy Mace and Mike Gallagher in Wisconsin. You know, you have these people talking about climate change all the time in a very pro-market and pro-limited government way. And there's a huge opportunity for conservatives to win on this. And the next generation is going to be the pro-climate conservative generation.
Yeah, that's interesting to me, because I personally definitely wouldn't rank climate change as my number one issue, partly because I'm more nihilistic on how much can be done. But a lot of people do, right? So is it a political necessity that you give an answer? Because just it's a Chinese hoax. Is it not an answer?
No, I mean, Joe Biden won the youth vote by astronomical margins, and he won the youth vote because he embraced topics like climate change. The climate is the number one or number two issue on almost all young people's ballots when they are on their minds when they go to the ballot box. And if you have one side saying, oh, this issue is real and it's really severe and we need to do something about it right now or yesterday, and then the other side says it's a hoax, you're giving young people one option. And, you know, people like you and I understand that it's not that, you know, black or white, that there are a lot of conservatives leading on it. But when the leader of a party in an election is saying that, it's really hard for young people to grapple with. And young voters are going to dictate the future of this country. And if they only see that one side cares about climate change, or they feel that way, then that side, whoever that is going to win. And then the other ideas that party and that idea that movement supports are also going to be put into place. And that's why the Green New Deal, to me, is a little bit more scary than I think a lot of people realize, because you do have this, like, one side saying that climate change is real and a really big deal. And when they get complete influence over our policymaking, which they very well could in the next couple of decades, then they can implement something like that.
So kind of to round us out on this subject before we get to the much coveted food take, if you could leave somebody with a 30-second takeaway about how they should view climate change differently, your average conservative voter or reader or listener, what would it be?
Our solutions work, and we need to have our voice at the table. It's going to take consumer-driven action and local action and also common sense conservative federal action if we want to tackle climate change, but it touches all parts of our lives, and it will touch even more of your life if we allow the other side to take this issue away and run with it. So let's lean in, let's lead on it, and let's come up with our solutions, because theirs aren't going to work. They're going to give themselves more power, and we can do it in a way that's good for all of us.
Yeah, there's an expression I've heard, if you're not at the table, you're on the table. And I think the reality is that when it comes to climate change, we need free market, limited government solutions, or we're going to end up with Green New Deal. And nobody on the right of center wants that. But Benji, before I let you go, I have to get your controversial food take.
So growing up, and this is something that I still love, chicken tenders and ice cream. Like chicken tenders dipped. Mixed? You like take a chicken tender and you dip it in ice cream, you eat part of it, then you dip more of it, then you eat part of it.
What kind of ice cream?
Oh, it doesn't matter. Anything, you know? I usually did like vanilla with, you know, maybe chocolate chips, some sort of vanilla base. But yeah, that's, you know, chocolate, you know, whatever you want. Strawberry, just try it.
Ice cream goes well with anything, honestly. I used to do that with Dairy Queen French fries.
That's not that controversial, because French fries are like, some people think it's gross, but most people I think do it in their hearts and minds. They know they do, but with this, can't knock until you try it.
All right. Well, that's certainly controversial. Benji, thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks. Thanks so much for having me. And thank you for your voice as well. You've been leaning into some really important topics for the next generation of our movement. And I'm just proud to know you and proud to be here.
Thanks. I will not be leaning into the chicken with ice cream, though. So, well, try again to convince me another time.
Maybe just one try.